Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Grant Norwood, president of NEC Operating and Norwood Energy Corp. During the episode, Grant breaks down the conventional operating space and discusses the opportunity set and different strategies for acquiring minerals in conventional oil and natural gas fields. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Grant had to say.
All right, Grant, good afternoon and welcome onto the podcast. Good to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Been listening to you for a while now.
Awesome. Yeah, no, we connected a few months back and love to have you on. We're going to have a little bit of a different conversation here. You're currently an operator in some conventional fields, and you got into the industry originally around minerals and kind of circled back to operating, but we're going to talk more buying minerals in the conventional space. So interested to kind of pick your brain on that. But before we do that, we'd love a little personal context. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? And how'd you get into the oil patch? Over to you to give us some background.
Yeah, happy to do that. I actually spent most of my childhood in Colleyville, Texas, a suburb of the Dallas-Fort Worth area, kind of right between the two, a little bit closer to Fort Worth, though, and spent also a lot of time at our ranch in Throckmorton. So it's not far west Texas, but you're getting there, if you will. And really, that's where I first learned what a pumping unit was. You know, you hear the word pump jack all the time, rocket horse, or whatever have you. But that's where I saw the first of them. And that's where I first kind of, I guess, developed an interest. And it wasn't like, you know, oh, hey, I want to jump straight into this when I grow up. Back then, I wanted to still be a fighter pilot. But I was curious as to what it did. And I really couldn't tell you all the way up probably until like middle school, you know, when a lot of things start making more sense. But went to Colleyville, graduated there, high school there, went to University of North Texas. And then getting into oil and gas, I was actually an intern for Dallas mayor at the time and met a land man. And he was willing to let me start on the ground floor. And it's actually humbling work. You know, you go into a courthouse, the clerk's office, and you're taking pictures of documents. And that's just so you can run through them real fast when you're in a competitive area. Time is of the essence. And you try to do everything as quick as you can just to kind of beat the other guy, so to speak. And that also plays a big role in minerals as well. But went from that to, actually running title to doing a mailing program all across Oklahoma. Scoop and Stack was really taking off, and parts of the scoop weren't quite identified yet. So that was all mysterious. We were all trying to figure out where it was going to go, who was going to be the first company out there to like file a permit, drill a well, take that risk. Is it going to work? Is it not going to work? You know, because it was really like at the time that so many people were entering the mineral space and trying to learn the game. And if you kind of learned half the game, you're in business. You know, there's so much to that. I mean, whatever, I guess, develop as a professional, how much more you kind of learn and like, say, once you hit 5 years or 10 years in the business versus like your first two or three, although you were doing business nonetheless and probably even could potentially on the same scale. So we were all just kind of looking around and it was like, who could get there first?
For context, I'm guessing, Scoop Stack, this is like 2013, 2016.
I would have loved to have been there at that point in time. I really didn't kind of enter till about 2014, early 15. I would have loved to have had that extra year, but I guess the stack was a lot more prominent for like mineral buying before I got there than the scoop. And why do I say that? Well, it's because you saw it extend over into McLean County, down into Garvin, down into Stevens, how far over west into Grady did it go? You know, a lot of these boundaries weren't quite identified yet. And even if you kind of knew from a geological standpoint how the basin was laid out and where the pay zones were found, like you still hadn't seen anybody actually sink a well and turn it on and get results. So you couldn't really model that out. But with the amount of competition you had, the prices went through the roof. And that's really how I got into oil and gas. It's just finding a mentor and just being grateful that he would show me a thing or two and I just took advantage of it to the best of my abilities. Before you knew it, it was just all go, go, go. And that all kind of came to a screeching halt.
Real quick, were you kind of independent and flipping deals? Were you working for a land brokerage? Were you buying on behalf of some larger groups?
Mm-hmm. Man, I'm just so blessed in a sense that, or privileged in a sense that the brokerage that I was kind of mentored by, you know, they treated me like as a man, even though I was, you know, just coming out of school and really basically with no experience other than like what they had told me. And I took it all as gospel because I didn't know any different, had no reason not to believe it. And they were seemed pretty good and talented at, you know, being successful in the business. So they would, what I would do is I would pitch in on these mailer programs. We'd have the people call back in. We'd build our spreadsheets and we go, okay, well, you take these and you take these. And we just comb through the data, you know, so independent kind of. I wouldn't say I was a partner. I think I didn't add enough value to be a partner, but I did add capital and gave it my best. And I would, you know, they'd purposely like take the better leads and I would not have any problem with that. I didn't want to mess up, you know, a 40 or 50 acre piece. I'd rather mess up a half acre or 2 acre
sure.
piece. And as I got proficient in it, now I was right up there, 10, now 20, now 30, till like we're kind of even. And then I started doing my own mailing program. They really put me in the business. If I'd had that extra year, like you were asking earlier, would have been nice because we really built an awesome database. At some point, I might try to get all that digital and just make it available to everybody because we spent a good portion of those years running a lot of title. And I'd just like to see it go use at least a little bit.
Welcome to An Ounce of Prevention. The team at Our Recent Associates has partnered with Tim Powell to bring you brief legal updates on issues that matter to mineral owners, non-ops, and operators. We hope you find this segment informative. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me, Rachel Reese, at rreese@rreeselaw.com. Today, we're doing something a little bit different. Instead of discussing a case, today's legal update is all about the Corporate Transparency Act, or the CTA. This is a long segment, but it's really important. If you own 25% or more of an entity, listen up. If you are an officer or manager of a company, listen up. And if you don't act soon, what's the penalty? $500 a day and potential jail time. Effective January 1st, 2024, all reporting companies, beneficial owners, and company applicants have a filing requirement with FinCEN under the CTA. We will break down each of these separately, but first, what's FinCEN? F-I-N-C-E-N stands for the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network and is an arm of the U.S. Department of Treasury. Its director reports to the Treasury Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. The CTA was passed as part of the U.S. government's efforts to make it harder for bad actors to hide or benefit from their ill-gotten gains through shell companies or other opaque ownership structures. The CTA applies to reporting companies, beneficial owners, and company applicants. A reporting company is any domestic or foreign entity created or registered by the filing of a document with the Secretary of State or a similar office. This includes corporations, limited liability companies, partnerships, and yes, it includes that LLC that you set up years ago, but never actually did anything with and forgot you had. Don't be fooled by its name. The Corporate Transparency Act does not just apply to corporations. Actually, it's just the opposite. Side hustles, investment entities, private equity portfolio companies are all reporting companies. A beneficial owner is any individual person who directly or indirectly either 1. Exercises substantial control over a reporting company. So we're talking officers, directors, managers, or anyone with significant voting rights. Or 2. Owns or controls 25% or more of the ownership interests of a reporting company. A company applicant includes anyone who either directly files the document that creates or registers the reporting company, or if more than one person is involved with the filing, the person who is primarily responsible for directing or controlling the filing. So what must be reported? Reporting companies must report their full legal name, any DBA or trade names, their business address, jurisdiction of formation, and tax ID number. Beneficial owners must report, in addition to their name, their residential address, date of birth, an ID number from either your driver's license or your passport, along with an image of that document. It's also worth noting that PO boxes are not accepted as the address for beneficial owners. FinCEN allows an alternative method of reporting by applying for a FinCEN identifier. This is a great option for folks who have to report as beneficial owners for many different companies. The FinCEN ID is sort of like TSA PreCheck. A beneficial owner can upload all of their information up front and receive a FinCEN ID. So instead of having to resubmit all of your data for each company, you just include your FinCEN ID on each report. So this is a lot of personal data. And understandably, the biggest concern we are hearing from our clients is about the confidentiality of this information. Information reported to FinCEN is stored in a secure, non-public database using rigorous information security protocols and controls, typically used by the government to protect non-classified but sensitive information at the highest security level. FinCEN will, however, permit government officials as well as certain foreign officials to obtain this information for national security, intelligence, and law enforcement reasons. With the consent of the reporting company, financial institutions can also get this information. Now that we've discussed what we're reporting on, let's talk about when these reports are due. The deadline for companies that were formed or registered before January 1st, 2024 is 1 year, so on or before December 31st, 2024. Companies formed this year will have 90 days to file. Companies formed or registered next year and after will have 30 days to file. These reports are not one and done. After you file your initial report, you have to file updated reports within 30 days of any change to your information. So if you move, change your name, or create a new DBA, you have to update. So why do you care? Well, civil fines of up to $500 a day and up to 2 years in jail. Full stop. We don't need any other reasons. But just in case you need a little more motivation to get your filings done, think about it this way. The Financial Crimes Enforcement Network is not the DMV. When FinCEN agents pay you a visit, they carry a badge and a gun. While the CTA is a federal law, we are also seeing some states take steps to adopt these reporting requirements at the state level. Our RNA will continue to stay up to date on the latest FinCEN guidance on the CTA and these state-level developments. I want to thank Miranda Caballero, an associate in our corporate and transactions team, for this update. Subscribe to our blog, An Ounce of Prevention, or follow us on LinkedIn for the latest updates.
The information and material in this advertisement is general information about our practice and firm and is for educational and informational purposes only. This information does not offer specific legal advice, and the use of this information does not create an attorney-client relationship with our RNA or any of its attorneys. The information in this advertisement should not be considered legal advice, and persons should not act upon this information without first engaging professional legal counsel.
Yeah, so continue. I cut you off. Apologies. I just wanted to kind of get a little more context on the mineral side. So you say it all kind of came to a halt, and then you made a little bit of a pivot, and then why don't you continue?
Yeah, okay. So when I made that comment, what I was referring to is these drilling units that I feel like was Devon and Chesapeake, if I'm not mistaken, that wanted to prove that the stack was indeed actually the stack. So instead of poking one, two, three, or at most four wells into a section, they decided they were going to put 12. And what happened was, you know, instead of paying four $10 million AFEs, they were paying 12 $10 million AFEs and getting less production out of the 12 than they would have four, which, you know, not being a reservoir petroleum engineer, I can't really describe the way that panned out. And I don't think they probably could at the time either, but hopefully something was learned there. All I know is the buyers were running and the sellers were pleading, and the landowners, if you hadn't already bought them, didn't really think that it made a whole lot of difference in the value. They still wanted what they were turning down the day before when you tried to buy them and then some. So now, you know, maybe they'll take a little less, but no, we'll hang on to what we got. So you couldn't get people to connect, because that's all you really were doing from my part of the business, or my part of the mineral business, was connecting buyers and sellers, whether you purchased it and then resold it or whatever have you. If you can't make money, then you're really not going to last very long. But putting those two together became really hard. And the, like I said, the buyers were scarce. I think you go from selling some things with like a single well at close to 100 months in cases to you can't get 36 months. And maybe some people see it differently, but that was my experience firsthand. So that's what got me to look in different areas of the business. You know, I love oil and gas. Feel like it's treasure hunting. It's exciting. It's that thrill I need as a professional to kind of, you know, be excited to go to work. So I'm like, what do I do now? I really don't want to build this database all over again, because I feel like it could happen anywhere. And then all the effort would go to waste, just like it did here in another area. So that's why I didn't continue. So as infatuated as I was, wonder if I could try my hand at operating. Well, that's a big ambition, especially if you want to do it on any kind of large scale without, let's say, working for, you know, somebody in one part of the business or another, till you had enough experience or clout or just whatever have you to be able to walk into private equity or family office and get funded. Well, I kind of see how those things go from friends of mine, and I really didn't want to take that route. And then I really didn't have the kind of money to do it without any help. But I purchased what I could. I'd done pretty good until the kind of fallout of the scoop and stack. So I actually bought a field in Kansas. And all the while, I learned how to kind of raise capital just from private investors by raising for a couple of friends that were already operators drilling projects. And from there, I could actually fund my field in Kansas workovers. And that went really well. And then I bought a gas field in Texas. And some of the employees from the company that I bought it from came with that field. And I still have those guys today. And they are my A team. And they're wonderful. Met all over the country, one of them all over the world, doing operations work. So then I had kind of a small team, took on an accountant, hired an attorney, the whole kit and caboodle. Got four geologists today. That time I took on two pretty much the same time. And before you know it, we're out drilling wells. It's amazing how fast it grew. And I mean, it really kind of, I wouldn't want to say it came easy because we all really busted our tails, but it went well.
So, you know, dialing it back a little bit. So obviously the technical reset and the scoop stack that you had mentioned caused a huge bid-ask spread. Operators fled, you know, capital fled, both private and public equities, right? Rig activity went way down. And it was just this huge chasm that existed in the mineral space. And it was just, you know, if you were caught holding the bag when the music stopped, you know, we've seen some of the carnage of some of the major buyers during that period or kind of sitting with those assets. And I don't think they ever get made whole, right? Even asset class like minerals, because they bought at the peak. And then the guys who were kind of at the bottom, you know, churning stuff and flipping it up the food stack, like yourself, that game stopped, right? And so this is, I'm guessing 2017, 18 is when you started looking at operated stuff. Is that correct?
There was a period of learning how to raise capital and also doing a lot of non-op because I kind of had retained a lot of interest because I couldn't sell it in Oklahoma. So I did have quite a bit of non-op and I was welcomed on some of the rigs. So I kind of just sat back and spectated and raised money. And then also, yes, bought the field in Kansas. But it was actually towards the end of 19, beginning of 20 is when I kind of started to grow. And I would just do bolt-ons like any EOP would. And it was all about what I could afford to do. But I felt like I needed to show myself I could do it before I felt comfortable using anybody else's capital. So when I could do it myself, then I was like, okay, mom, dad, you know, friends, family, hey, I think this is what we need to do. That went well, and it just spread like wildfire. It really is, I'm here to preach it, amazing how fast the interest level grows when you make people money back and then it continues to fall in. Because I really didn't have to try that hard. I'm only kind of limited by my own bandwidth due to some of the successful ventures we've had. But yeah, so.
Congrats on bootstrapping it and kind of pivoting out of necessity, right? With what we're
yes.
That. So you kind of alluded, so your initial foray into conventional operating was Kansas. And that was the main driver of that was, hey, I want to self-fund this and I need to go conventional just because the cost of entry to the poker table is just a lot smaller and a lot less competition. Was that really the impetus? I mean, did you look at other types of assets before you landed the Kansas deal? I'm just curious. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about, did you buy that from a group? Did you go out and put the leasehold together? What did that all look like?
Wonderful question. Nobody really asked that, but I'm excited to kind of describe it. I was such a big naysayer of Kansas. I mean, I watched Chesapeake get up there, break their pick. I watched Sandridge get up there and break their pick. I think there's one more, but I can't recall who it was. But they tried to take that Alfalfa County, Oklahoma, Mississippi line play and extend it on up into Kansas. So if you're in the mineral business, you probably remember chasing those permits. And it didn't work. So from there, I just saw a lot of seismic-based drilling and kind of felt real high risk. But really, I just didn't know anything about it. And as horizontal drilling and kind of the whole shale world matures and people start going, okay, well, what else is there out there? They're going to be kind of facing some of the same realities I did. And it's like, you got to learn the business all over again. It's completely different, 100% different. So I really did not think that Kansas was going to be that place. It was just by chance that I was evaluating a deal. I at that time should not have been evaluating a deal to recommend it for anybody, and wanted to speak with the kind of the syndicator. Well, he was a geologist from Kansas, only ever worked Kansas, and I really took a liking to him, and I think vice versa. And I'm not saying I like Soleiman myself, but really, I think he kind of believed in me on one side of the coin and didn't want to mess with it anymore on the other side of the coin. But I mean, I bought the thing at like 8 months cash flow and improved it quite a bit from there. And had he not done that, I don't know how much longer it would have taken me to climb the ladder, because I mean, I out of the gate got to start with like 15 barrels a day and, you know, 300 MCF of gas. And, you know, it's just me. I didn't have much overhead. I improved everything by nearly double, and we were rocking and rolling, and we were in business. So, and I say we, it was I at the time, but it became we very quickly.
Are you serious about networking and deal making in the minerals and royalty space? If so, I expect to see you at the MARC Mineral and Royalty Conference at the Post Oak Hotel in Houston on April 15th and 16th. This must-attend event will bring together over 600 attendees for two action-packed days of networking and discussions. Be sure to visit mineralconference.com to get registered for your ticket today.
Very cool. So, and then just walk through the rest of your portfolio and kind of where the fields are. And then what I'd like to do, you know, the remainder of the episode is really talk about the conventional space and the opportunity to do leasehold and minerals. I think, you know, a lot of the episodes that we have and the guests we have on are larger funds. They're chasing the drill bit in these unconventional plays because of the large flush production that comes on, right? And the ability to put a lot of capital work. But, you know, buying royalties and conventional assets, especially if they're producing already, it's just pancake-like declines, right? And you, some areas, you know, are water flood, and you can almost get incline on the production curve, right? In certain areas where production is stimulated and far less competition. So that all sounds great in theory, but, you know, addressable market, what does the mineral ownership look like in these basins? Is it fragmented? Are there not that many? How much money can put to work? I want to go into all that, but let's finish setting the table. So you got this field in Kansas. You mentioned a gas field in Texas. Where in Texas? Is this kind of panhandle?
Cherokee County, just right there by Angelina County and Harrison. We're just barely west of all of the activity that you see going on in the Haynesville, a little bit south and west. There's kind of like the rumors with the new Bossier thing going on. So we're just kind of right there on the edge. It's a salt dome. It was discovered by Exxon, developed by Samson, had a big exit. Samson had a very big exit to Lime Rock, who eventually had a tough go with it. And it passed through two more hands, I believe, and then into mine. But that's the East Texas gas field. So it's just right there in Cherokee County. You see Buffco's got a bunch of wells around there. Those are real cool guys. And then just a handful of other operators. But that's where the East Texas gas field is.
And then do you have any other assets you're operating in the portfolio?
Oh, yeah. No, I've got a big kind of, it's part of it's water flood. Part of it's just still on primary. It was a Devon field. It's all straw and caddo in North Texas. And that's going to be in Wise County. I've got a field in, what was that? Bartley and Oldham County in the Panhandle. Stevens County, we've got a pretty large water flood. That thing is Old Faithful. I think I've had to work on one well in the last 2.5 years. It's just a cash machine. And then I've got in Upton County, who was at Capstone's field, that they were developing a lot of horizontal straw and maybe doing some testing in some other zones, which is really interesting because there are companies out drilling and testing the viability or opportunity of the kind of the deeper Barnett and Woodford that's underneath what we always kind of talked about and looked at is, you know, your primary Permian zones. So that could open up a whole new wave of exploration. And I think it already has. It's just, although it's kept caught on, I don't think that big companies' budgets have been allocated towards it. Cause I mean, you'll see Apache go drill 2 or 3 wells here, scoot over and drill 2 or 3 wells there. You know, a couple other companies just doing the same thing, but you haven't seen anybody go drill 30 or 40 of them and really try to learn it. So some of the results on those wells look really, really good. And then I'd say probably a little bit better than half of them you'd probably be scared of, but I just feel like we hadn't learned it yet. And as we do, it's going to be pretty exciting. And one of the things that'll keep even the horizontal mineral game alive a little bit longer, because that's not the only one, as we saw in Leon and Robertson County, that's happening like that. That's Texas. I just sold out in Borden County to, I guess it's, I'm not under any NDA, but Surge, who's partnered with EOG at the moment in Borden County. That was really nice. They needed my infrastructure and I got out of that one. We got a small field in southern Oklahoma, a large field in northern Louisiana, and then everything else from there is in Kansas. And it starts when you get out of Oklahoma and it ends when you get Nebraska. So they're just kind of all the way up in kind of Wichita West.
No, listen, thanks for walking through all that. So are you doing any drilling? Are you doing mostly workover and EOR type programs on your assets?
We're doing a good bit of drilling. We've drilled 26 wells in the last 12 months in Kansas. We haven't drilled anything in Texas, but we've got a lot of that planned for this year. So I'm stoked to actually get down in our home state and do some drilling there. But yeah, we do drill, but it's been all in Kansas thus far. And you know, a lot of the stuff in Kansas, it's probably between, last year we were drilling a little bit shallower stuff. It was between like 3,800 and 4,200 feet. We go farther west. We don't even kind of start seeing pay zones of interest till about 4,400 feet and all the way through like 6,200 is where some of our TDs go. So it's relative, it's like between shallow and deep. You know, it's not one or the other. But Texas, we've got a lot of opportunity there in Upton County, and we'll be coming up against some of the bigger players if we want to grow our position, which might get me back out into the land side again. So I'm looking forward to that too.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, one of the reasons to have you on, right? When we were chatting a couple months back, we were talking minerals and leasehold. You know, you're not set up to do that now. You're more focused on operations, but, you know, going out, putting bolt-on positions together, maybe proving up your NRI, right? Under your footprint. You have data, you have, you know, landowner information, and then you also have, you know, a drill schedule and a workover program in hand. And, you know, whether you do that yourself or partnering with someone is something we were kind of kicking around. So let's just kind of have some fun here and play the hypothetical game. So whether it's Upton County, whether it's Kansas, you know, these are not, we'll start with Kansas, right? This is not an area I hear many folks buying in. If you wanted to go and buy minerals in and around your position, is that really doable? Is there an opportunity set there? And if so, I mean, what does that look like? Are you looking at tons and tons of tiny fractured interests? Are these people accessible? You know, over to you, just what does that look like? And what are you typically seeing like on an acreage basis? Is it, you just got to buy a bunch of stuff everywhere and hope it hits, or can you be rifle shot? Is the juice worth the squeeze? Just curious to hear your thoughts.
Okay, so Kansas, it's interesting that because I would say better than half of the people we go to lease are surface and mineral owner. And it's beautiful to an operator and it's hospitable to an operator because you get that one lease signed, you got 1 to 4 drilling locations, let's call it, in just a regular quarter. In Texas, I'd say even on a good day, you're talking about 8 to 15, which makes the landman in Kansas's head spin, you know, and that's on a good day. In Texas, you might have 400 or 500, 1,000, you know, and it's not always that bad, but you see it and you see it often. So you're not really buying these little fragmented pieces. I'm really trying to think of an angle, you know, because these people know you're coming to them, approaching them, and they're kind of skeptical that, like, why are you interested in these minerals? What do I have here? Like it probably was once upon a time in Texas, but, you know, you have some that'll sell, some need the money. I wouldn't say it's an impoverished state, but it's, if you're either a farmer or you're in oil or you're in some kind of like service, and everyone seems to have decent holdings from top to the bottom. Like what I say is, like a Texas resident, you know, where I live here, your home might be on a half acre. Not necessarily out there. It's a little bit more sizable positions. So you get those and they'll sell smaller pieces. But one angle I've thought about trying is maybe kind of guaranteeing that you'll, or putting a drilling clause in your lease. So long as, you know, you sell it, the mineral outfit, maybe 10%, 20%. Because once you break them out of their hands, then you've got something. But it really is hard to convince them that they don't need to have them, because the bigger landowners versus the smaller landowners, bigger landowners don't just own one quarter. If they own a quarter, they probably own 20 of them. That's what I found. It's like, you know, you'll have your pumper go, oh, I've got you 13 quarters. This guy wants the lease. You know, who brought him? A hero. Well, everybody's got that up there, you know, and unless it's right there in the right spot. I mean, it's really insignificant. And I say right spot, right there where you're hoping to be able to drill. So those guys, they don't need the money. They like there's little to do out there. So it's almost amusing to them to have the activity, and they're going to come hang out with you on the rig the whole time. So it's hard to get your hands on them in Kansas. But if you do, I mean, you got $10, $20 lease bonus on the acreage, and you pick up 40 acres, and that well's on a 40-acre spacing, you've got that whole eighth or fifth, whatever royalty rates you signed up for. So that matters when you hit a 50-barrel a day well that makes $100,000 a month, and you've got, let's call it between an eighth and a quarter, let's call it a 15%. You know, that matters whenever, I don't know, if we do the math, you might have $4,000 in that 40 acres. So the numbers work out real good.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com.
Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has been a leading ground game broker for minerals and non-op deals, closing over 120 transactions across the Permian, SCOOP/STACK, Haynesville, Bakken, Powder River Basin, DJ, and Eagleford. With deal sizes ranging from $50,000 upwards of $5 million and 1.5 NRAs upwards of 3,500 NRAs, the Texas Mineral Company can be flexible on where and how they can source your deal flow. For more information on how your team can work with the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com.
Scaling up your portfolio while minimizing G&A is the name of the game in the minerals and non-op space. Whether you're a brand new fund, an established team who's growing quickly, or a fully developed portfolio in harvest mode, Opportune's back office outsourcing team can help. Stop worrying about all the headaches that come along with day-to-day accounting and back office operations and contact Opportune today. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Hi there, it's Rachel Reese at R. Reese & Associates, your outhouse counsel. You may ask, what's an outhouse counsel? Well, it's a law firm that is focused on the day-to-day legal tasks that normally would be completed by your legal department. Our attorneys in Houston and DFW have spent their careers in both in-house positions and at large law firms and can provide your company with the efficient and responsive service you would expect from your own legal department for things like contracts, transactions, and title opinions at a fraction of the cost of what you're used to paying. So whether your company has no legal department or your legal department is a mighty team of one, we can help. Give us a call at 832-831-2289 or learn more at rreeselaw.com.
Yeah, so, you know, the other thing, I get every once in a while texts from folks that say, hey, Tim, I'm in the oil patch and I want to get started in minerals. What do you recommend? And it's, they're not really, there's nothing really more than that other than, you know, they like the asset class, they see all the activity and they want to jump in on it. And I think it's really difficult. It, you know, they don't have, you know, anything special or tons of money to jump into the Permian, for instance. But you kind of like how you got into conventional operating, I think going into buying minerals in conventional fields might be a good starter strategy for self-funded groups who maybe want to put 50, you know, 250, you know, $400,000 to work, and you're not going to buy yourself a half an acre in the Permian. You'll actually have a little bit of meat on the bone, right?
I totally agree with that. I would say, you know, with that kind of a budget, you have to do some of the land and title yourself just to kind of cut down on some of the costs. But if somebody came up to me and was willing to do that, and, you know, whether we split it or whether we, you know, beat dollar for dollar, you just do the legwork, whatever we come up with, you kind of have to have a little bit of an understanding of where you want to be, because the size of these ownerships, like I was saying, like they'll own all these quarters or whatever, and they're not going to sell all the quarters. Or if you were to get them to sell, let's say a quarter of one, you know, it's going to be difficult to the point where you're not going to, I guess, what am I trying to say? You're not going to have 5 acres that you can go pick up in every quarter or even section that's going to be available. The swaths of land are too big for that. So I think that you'd almost need to be with an operator. I think the operator would love to have it. I don't know too many people that are doing that. It's just not been brought, the ideas haven't been brought out there. So it's ripe. I'd say it's very ripe for the picking.
And yeah, I guess, you know, line of sight partnerships with operators on the mineral buying front is something that has become more in vogue the last 5-6 years in these unconventional plays. And, you know, the small mom and pop operators, family run shops like yourselves, there's a window of opportunity in conventional areas to go in and partner, and just both parties can benefit, right? Because there's not just rig activity everywhere, it's essential to be, you know, on the side of the operator to get that visibility, because getting this stuff to shake loose is hard and it's chunky, and there's a very good chance you can just get a bunch of stuff that's cow pasture, right? If you don't know of where the activity is going. No, that's interesting. What about, is that similar, would you say, in some of the other conventional fields you operate, the stuff in East Texas and elsewhere, you know, the Oklahoma field, or is it different state by state?
Well, I can describe it to you. So we have about 9,500 acres in that one field in East Texas, and there's 6,000 mineral owners, and it's growing by the month. So you could kind of just use mental math to just, or just by and large. So what did that come out? Does that come out to like a little over an acre a person on average?
Well, not big, yeah.
So having the decks on something like that, because would you want to run title on 14 different units with that many owners? Probably not if you don't have to. So that's where like that partnership, like a Franco Nevada, a Continental, or a Diamondback, the Fang kind of deal. Yeah. So just something like that could be real useful to the operator and real lucrative to the mineral buyer and save them tons of time and effort. Get them into stuff that, you know, there's line of sight on stuff like we were saying.
No, for sure. Yeah. So comparatively speaking, you know, Kansas is, you know, a little bit of a chunkier, larger land positions. They own surface and title. East Texas, a little more fragmented and growing probably with generational wealth transfer, right? And
yeah, because I mean, if you got somebody making $17 a month and, you know, there's 8 family members or whatever, but you buy all 8 of them, you rework that well that's 10 MCF and you put it in another zone and that's making $500,000. Well, shoot, now you got something much more significant that's in the mid 4-digit figures, and you bought it at, you know, 60 months on less than $20. That works. That turns profit.
Yeah, no, for sure. No, the other thing that's interesting is, you know, kind of workover and EOR programs. So, you know, if you're going in, you're buying something that's been producing the same amount forever, and then you're able to double production for a handful of years, and, you know, you're buying existing cash flow stream, and then you get that nice pop, you know, from a return perspective, that becomes interesting as well. I think, again, collaborating with an operator like yourselves, there's something there. I think there's a limit in the amount of dollars you can deploy in something like this, but for smaller self-funded mineral shops, I think there's something viable there for sure.
Definitely. We've got one, or the one in Wise County, it's one that I can't wait to actually, it sounds crazy, it's so great that I can't wait to sell it. And that's just because it, like, then it goes on the wall, a plaque on the wall, like, here's a full cycle deal. But when I got that field, there's like 95 wells there. There's just shy of 60 of them equipped. And there was 3 running, making 13 barrels a day. I've got 14 running, making 77 barrels a day. Then I've got to convert another one to disposal / injection because I can't take it on any more water and turn on additional wells. And, you know, pick any number when I can put on another 14 wells, what will be producing at that point. All those mineral owners just hit the jackpot. They're going to make bank. And I've got not a single addition to my NRI. And, you know, a little bit of strategy like we're discussing, I mean, could have been very valuable. And I mean, they still can, because we're going to continue to improve. But just the dramatic change in value from, you know, 13, 14 barrels a day to 77. And one of the things that like I want to point out when you're talking about conventional minerals, it's a different like headspace or train of thought, because we're not dealing with 1280s and then allocating like a third of the wellbore in this section and then, you know, another two thirds in that section. So you kind of look at it and go, okay, well, 1 acre used to be 3 zeros, 292968. It was your decimal interest per acre, or half that for a royalty acre, or yeah, that's a 316. And then when you got into, when we started going to two section laterals, then, you know, you're going, okay, well, instead of 2929, we're 1456 for a decimal interest. You're dealing with like 320 acre units on a gas well and 40 to 80 acre units on an oil well. And you can get shallow oil wells that are 2 acre units. Like they're really shallow, but you start at 2 acres, then you go up to 5 and up to 10. Well, in the conventional world, buying 6 acres is not very significant. Buying 6 acres out of 8 acres in our world is wildly significant. You know, so when you can get in there and buy these divided, undivided interests, and they cover several of your spacings, you come out of that smelling like a rose.
Let me ask you a question in a different way. So if I'm the right kind of group with the right capital profile, et cetera, and this all sounds interesting to me and I might want to investigate, maybe I call you, maybe I call another operator that's operating in a different conventional area and I explore this strategy. You know, we're in a era right now in oil and gas of super consolidation, scale to drive down, you know, service costs and all that stuff, right? And just the bigger you are, the better position you are with service companies and increase the margins, try to cut out G&A, so on and so forth. The smaller operators in the unconventional space, I had a couple of lunches this week, and they're just talking about the challenges of being smaller and managing your service costs. And you're basically just the marginal user of a lot of this equipment and services that's left over from the bigger guys. And as a result, you pay more. In the conventional space and work over rigs and that type of equipment, I mean, how, as a small private operator, how have you guys found it in this current environment with getting access to the equipment and crews, cost, inflation, all that, to make the numbers work to be profitable? Because if I'm a minerals buyer looking at this, I'm just curious, you know, everything is smaller relative to unconventional, but, you know, this is a different world, different equipment, different everything. And, you know, the hypothetical is technology's gotten a whole hell of a lot better in the last 15 years. Is there a way to bring new technology into, you know, enhance oil recovery and, you know, secondary, you know, tertiary type stuff and workovers and all that in a way that's very, very cost efficient, where it might have been harder 10, 15 years ago before shale came up? We'd love for you to expand on that.
So I guess where I would start is, you know, in shale, you're looking at these break evens and who, depending on who you ask, you might have a different point of view on a break even or whatever. Or let's use the word lift cost per se. You know, what does it cost to develop this 50,000 barrels? Like what do we have total into it? What do we have, you know, month to month basis, whatever have you? Ours, I mean, my lift cost is like on a new well, it's going to be 45, 50, 60 cents. You're talking in some place in the horizontal world, $40, $50. So it's infinitely smaller. You know, I don't have these massive buildings. I don't fly guys around on jets. I don't have the overhead. You know, I don't have departments that have 40, 50 people or 300 people or a whole floor that you have these massive salaries for. You know, I've got what I have, about a 8,000 square foot office in South Lake, Texas with 17 employees in it. You know, that's like nothing compared to them. So our cost structure is different. And I think that makes up for a lot of the things that, you know, you would think would break us. You'd think it would break us. And unless you're kind of raising capital, a lot of the operators that are on our level, they don't do any drilling because they can't take the dry hole risk. And I don't think any of the shale companies or many of the shale companies could either in this conventional world, because although, like, you know, the wells, it's kind of like, I always look at the horizontal and drilling and shale game is more like hot potato. You get out there, you put together an acreage position and you throw the hot potato before the music stops. You drill a few wells and you prove it a little bit and you hot potato it again and make a little bit of money. You don't want to be the last guy with the potato in his hand when that music stops, because you're the one that goes bust. And I think that, you know, all these companies are having to consolidate and they're having to go, okay, well, we're going to have to write down some of these assets. We're going to have to live with with this value, and we're going to have to milk these wells for a long time, try to figure out if there's another way to produce out of them, because we really didn't make any money to speak of. You know, all we did was spend a bunch of it. You know, like look at Chesapeake's, the Goodriches, the Lens, the shoot, I'm trying not to talk about companies I admire a lot, but the profitability just hasn't been there. So it's kind of nice this past year when prices were high that everybody's like, wait, we're not going to screw ourselves again. We made enough gas to bring the gas prices down, and we have not seen them until last year. That was great. But we haven't seen, you know, $7, $8, $9, $10 gas. We haven't seen that since we've got overly aggressive. We've had so many different price wars and everything else. We're going to return to shareholders. That was kind of cool to see. And had that been done earlier on, I think that there'd be a lot stronger opinion for the guys like myself about that business model. But what it does do is, because they're high costs and they can't drill the dry holes. So you have to raise capital to be able to do that, because it is speculative. And those that speculate get tremendous tax benefits, and you get them in the horizontal world too. They were originally intended for kind of what we're doing. And when you win, you really do win in this space. But I would say that when you get these fields, either you've got them to a point where they are cruising along and you can show economics to a buyer, and when you're tired of messing with it or you get old and it's time to move on, you share those economics with the buyer. The buyer knows what he's getting into, and you plan for things. I mean, I always try to set aside cushions. You do have workovers, and we are small. We can't just take anything. But I don't really have any troubles. Like, there's not been a time yet where I'm sitting there going, oh, how am I going to pay for this? What am I going to do? And it's not like, I'm not saying we have the best assets in the world, but we have good assets, and the profit margins are quite large. Like, most of our fields have their own disposals. If they don't, we're not in such competitive areas that it's 75 cents or a dollar to dispose. We're not paying $3 to haul it, and we're not making 850 barrels of water to one barrel of oil. So I don't know how much, I don't want to just run it in the ground, but it's not yes, the rigs cost the same day rate for us as they do for that big boy, but we only take 5 days to drill a well. So if you were to sit beside me and just shadow me for a week, it'd start to make a little bit of sense. This business model, it's more profitable than our counterpart.
No, that's fascinating. And just given the high margins and, you know, not drilling new wells and just working over existing stuff, you can ride out volatility on the commodity price side, right? And still survive, right? Overexposed. Right. And then you just operate within cash flow. Now that's interesting.
Well, see, we don't have the 90-day cessation of production, all that. We're not going to lose our leases if our wells go down for more than 90 days. If they go down for more than a year, yes. But that leeway makes it a lot easier in a low pricing environment.
For sure. For sure. All righty. Well, Grant, listen, it's been fun to kind of kick around some ideas with you. I think hopefully you got the wheels turning upstairs for a few folks listening. Maybe if there's any interest, I encourage you to reach out to Grant to talk about maybe partnering together on some of his positions from a minerals buying standpoint. And yeah, listen, look forward to keeping in touch, and thanks for sharing your thoughts. Keep growing your business. Congrats on bootstrapping it, and look forward to connecting in person soon.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. Maybe we'll do a follow-up if somebody does connect and pursue some of this stuff.
You bet. We're looking forward to it. Thanks again, Grant. Right.
Thanks, Tim.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.